We're going to speak of the Exodus because that's, according to at least a lot of people, the name of the book. And what I think the title of the class, I generally don't know the title until I finish, but I think the title today is going to be The Trajectory of the Exodus, or The Trajectory of Geula. And let's start in the first source, which is the very beginning of this week's parsha. And the main reason I want to start with that source is to make sure that at least I do something in this week's parsha. V'dibir Elokim Moshe v'yomer lo v'ani Hashem. And God, and the different names of God are significant here, but God says, I am God. There are a lot of translators and people who translate the Chumash who don't pay attention to which name of God is being used in any particular, you know, situation, so therefore the translation of that verse would be, and God said, I am God, but Elohim, I would say the Almighty, said, Ani Hashem, I am the Eternal, especially in this context, especially over here. V'ra'al Avraham l'Yitzchak v'Yaakov b'kel Shakai, and I revealed myself to the patriarchs through the aspect of Kel Shakai. I believe I mentioned things about this last week. The name Shakai is very often connected to Yosef. It starts when God gives the command to Avraham in terms of Brit Milah. It, I think, almost always has to do with procreation, and it's the blessing of God giving a blessing. Ushmi Hashem lo nodati lahem. But the name Yudke Vavke was not really known to them. And I put in the word really because we do find that God reveals himself to the Avot. So the question is, what really does this mean? But then I'm skipping a little bit. Now, God is about to give a speech. And before I get to the speech that God gives, I do want to go a little bit backward, and I want to see what was really happened beforehand that God is responding to. Because, again, this is not in a vacuum. Something just now happened. It's also interesting that our parasha begins in Pasuk Bet, verse 2. We Jews, for whatever bizarre reason, have all become students of the Archbishop of Canterbury, and we take his divisions quite seriously. But it's interesting over here is that he ends last week's parsha, which is source number two. He ends it, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Atatiresh Eseh LaParo. You're going to see what I'm going to do to Paro. Ki biyad chazaka yishalchem, biyad chazaka yigarshem me'artzo. With a strong hand going to... But it's interesting because he's talking about Paro. By the way, I think that's part of the problem. And I really want to focus on what I think the problem is over here. Why is Paro part of the story? I know you're going to say that Paro is a big part of the story. I want to say this clearer. Why is Paro part of the story? If the objective is to take the Jews out, and I'll say even clearer, the stated objective is to take the Jews to Eretz Israel. And he's going to say it right now in source number one. He's going to say, go back to number one and look at Pasuk Dalid, Vagami Kimoti Epriti. I'm going to keep the covenant, Itam, the one that I made with the patriarchs, Latet Limit Eretz Canaan, the land of Israel. So I'm going to say it again. I'm sorry for the Zionist overtones over here. I'm sorry for the Zionist overtones, but what can I do? That's exactly what it says over here. It says that's the objective. The objective is to get to the land of Israel. But that's the objective, to go to the land of Israel. So if the objective is to go to the land of Israel, why not just bring them directly to the land of Israel? Why are we negotiating with Paro? I mean, you negotiate with somebody when you need something. You don't need anything from Paro. So I'll say it again. Why is Paro part of the story? Just marginalize him in terms of history. Say goodbye. Time to leave now. You're not a part of this. This has nothing to do with you. I want to say it even stronger based upon a commentary that I absolutely love. It's in Perek Yutet, Pasuk Dalet. That's when the Jews arrive at Har Sinai. There it says, and God says, I brought you to me on wings of eagles. I brought you to me, right? So if you look at the Targum Yonatan on that Pasuk, Targum Yonatan is, first of all, not the Targum Yonatan. Okay? Don't ask. But it's not the Targum Yonatan on Chumash. In Navi it is, in Chumash it isn't. It was a mistake by the printers, but it's so they refer to it as pseudo-Yonatan. It's not Targum Yonatan. Second, the Targum Yonatan is not, it's a Targum, but it's more than a Targum, which means he brings lots of Midrashim, and he brings lots of other ideas within it. This Pasuk, he brings the most beautiful idea. He says that I flew you out on Ananeha Kavod, which are like the wings of eagles, on Pesach Eve, I took you to Yerushalayim, I took you to the place of the Beit HaMikdash, and you brought the Korban Pesach there, and then I brought you back so that I can take you out of Egypt. Now, I hope I don't have to tell all of you that that's not what happened. Okay? If you want me to use stronger language, I can say that that's absolutely preposterous, and what in the world is he talking about? But he's actually saying something which is completely true, and that's what I want to explain. It's completely true what he's saying. but it's just not historically true. And in our minds, that's part of the problem that sometimes we have when we read Midrash, is that we only look for historical truth and we don't look for other things, for example, like emotional truth. Which means when the Jews were able to serve God finally that night and bring the Korban Pesach that night, where were they experientially? Where were they within their hearts? You know, and every night on Pesach, and I think this is quite ironic, every night on Pesach, what are we supposed to do? We have to go and bring ourselves backwards into the past in order to see ourselves as if we're slaves, in order to see ourselves as if we leave. They also saw themselves as if they left. And that's what the Targum Yonatan is saying. As I said, I think it's remarkable. It means that they were able to project themselves into the future, being a free people, having their own land, sitting in the capital of Jerusalem, which is completely built by the Beit HaMikdash, and bringing the Korban Pesach. So what the Targum Yonatan is saying is absolutely true in terms of the experiential, in terms of the emotions, in terms of what they felt, even though they were still sitting in Egypt that night. So I'm saying is that, you know, truth has an interesting thing. I'm not making a postmodern statement that anything can mean anything. I'm just saying is that there's one thing what actually happens to a person, and there's another thing what a person actually feels and experiences. And a person's feelings and experiences happen to be significant. That's part of the secret of leaving. That's part of the secret, is to be able to anticipate that future. It's actually the reason why, and this is in Explorations, this is actually the reason why they ate matzah that night. Why do we eat matzah? Because they left so quickly, they didn't have time for the matzah to rise. But they were commanded 2 weeks before to have a matzah sale and to buy the matzah and have it prepared and then eat it that night before they even left. Why eat matzah before they left? Because they know that when they leave, they're going to leave so quickly they don't even have time for the matzah to rise, which means they're already living in the future. I'll make another statement about this. And I don't mean now to belittle at all any types of emotional issues that people have. Depression is something which is terrible, but what happens when people are depressed? They let things which happened in the past dictate their present, and they get stuck in the present, and they don't have a belief in tomorrow. And people who are able to get past trauma that happened in the past, they believe tomorrow will be a better day. When you believe tomorrow will be a better day, then you get liberated from the past. And what God is doing on a collective level is He's taking them out of the slavery. He's taking them out of the past and having them feel and anticipate the future which is going to unfold. And once you believe in that future, you can see yourself in Jerusalem, at that moment you become free. Which means the Jews actually became free Pesach night, even though they didn't leave till the next morning. But if Pesach night they were able to already anticipate and feel the leaving of the next morning, they were already free the night before. But let me go back to why I mentioned that Targum Yonatan, because I love the imagination of the being flown out on the Anani HaKavod, and then you have to ask yourself, so why didn't God do that? God has that in His arsenal. God can say, okay, I'm flying you out right now. By the way, God could have flown them out. He could have built them apartments, give everybody a parking space. Right, he could have given them underfloor heating and anything else that you may need in this city. So why doesn't God do all of that? Because I don't want an answer. I'm just pointing out that God could have done that and chose not to do that. And on top of all that, God turns Paro into part of the story, and that's really what I'm getting back to. And when we go back to the end again of last week's parsha and start with source number 2. God sent Moshe, and you realize from the very beginning Moshe was hesitant. Moshe always seems to be like he's shaking his head at God. No, this is not going to work. You know, who am I? And on and on and on. And I think Moshe does so much of this. A, we know that Moshe is the most modest man who ever lived, and that actually makes him very attractive as a leader. On the other hand, we sort of get a sense at some point, did he overdo it a little bit? Because the Jews are suffering. Why aren't you going? Why aren't you agreeing? God says, I got your back. When God says He's got your back, God's got your back. So, like, go. V'charbo Moshe v'Aaron, which, by the way, itself is problematic, because all the elders were supposed to go with them, and they sort of disappeared along the way. You know, send my people, they'll celebrate. So what does Paro say? Never heard of him. Source number 2, Pasuk Bet. And Paro's response is, I never heard of him. I just don't know who you're talking about. L'shalachi Yisrael. Lo yadati et Hashem. The Gamit Yisrael lo shalach. He goes, forget it, I'm not doing it. Now, this pasuk is actually more important than we imagine. Because when we read this, we get disappointed and say, hold it, you know, this is terrible. This pasuk actually explains much more than you think it does. So I want to go back, and everything I'm going to do today is going to be disjointed. I'm already letting you know, and I really apologize for that. I can claim that it's a pedagogical tool to keep moving from place to place to keep you all awake, but it's completely disjointed. The most important, you know, you talked about Maaseh Avot Simon LeBanim, and that's true. You know, Avram and Sarah going to Egypt, and then Avram felt threatened, the men would be killed, and they took Sarah, the girls they're going to take. And then the Paro got struck by plagues, and they left with Avram with great wealth, with the Chush Gadol. All that is the story of leaving Egypt in a microcosm. And that's actually the source that the Ramban uses for Maaseh Avot Simon LeBanim, which is based upon the Midrash Tanchuma. But as much as that's an important part of the story, there's one other thing which is important, and I would even venture to say more important, and that is when God speaks to Avram and tells him what's going to take place over the next 400 years. And that, of course, is the Brit Bein HaBetarim, which is in source number 7. V'yiyah Shemesh Lavo, and the sun came to set, v'tardema nafla al Avram, and Avram fell into a slumber. V'nei emach ha-sheikh ha-gdola nofelet alav. But not only, you know, did he fall into a slumber, there was fear, there was darkness that descended upon him. V'yomel Avram, and God said to Avram, Yodea teda, and I'll just point out now, the word yodea or teda or knowledge is a subtext all the way through the Yitziat Mitzrayim. And it's something to pay attention to. It's both in the Chumash and it's also in the Haftarah as well. You should surely know, ki geyeh zaracha be'eretz lo lahem. They're going to be strangers in a land which isn't theirs. But by the way, the construction of this pasuk, one really needs to know how to read the trup to understand how to read the pasuk. I'm going to read it again. V'yom levam yodeya teda ki geyeh zaracha be'eretz lo lahem. V'avadum v'inu otam. Now, the etnachta is on the taf of the otam, Arbamot Shana, which means the Arbamot Shana actually, you don't read it through, but you pause by the Otam, and the Arbamot Shana actually modifies what's earlier in the verse, which means that they are going to be in a land which isn't theirs for 400 years, but it doesn't say what some may think it says, that they will be enslaved for 400 years, which means I don't have to come on to the explanation that it was supposed to be 400 years and God cut time off, because it's not actually what the pasuk says. The 400 years goes from the very beginning that they will be in a land which isn't theirs. And therefore, when it says that you start counting from the time that he has Zerah, from the time that Yitzhak is born, Yitzhak is in a land which isn't his. It's not his land. So therefore, the 400 years, that's what Chazal tell us. I'm saying that's not an imaginative shot. That's what it says in the pasuk. That from the birth of Yitzhak, we're going to be counting 400 years. And during that time, there's going to be Avodah and Inui, which means there's going to be enslavement and there's going to be abuse. Now, of course, the abuse is not defined. It doesn't tell us exactly what it is, but I want to continue. V'gamata goya sher yavodu dan anochi. But it's interesting that those who enslave you, I am going to judge. That's the reason that Paro's part of the story. Now, Paro, if he had a good lawyer, the lawyer could have said, excuse me, my client was acting within the will of God. This is what God had told to Avram, that his children will be enslaved. So if this is God's will, I was doing the will of God. Now, as much as you may not like that, because then, of course, you could have responded, who said you should fulfill this particular will of God? Nonetheless, I think that explanation could gain more traction than I think that sometimes we feel comfortable with. And it does go into the whole issue of free will, and the Rambam in the Laws of Tshuva spends 2 chapters on free will, the 5th and the 6th chapters, and he does get into Paro along the way over here. But there's a couple things we can say. One is we can say is that it says servitude. It never said anything about of taking the children and throw them into the water. There's nothing about killing children along the way over here, which means servitude, yes. Murder, no. What gave you the right to murder people? The second thing is that Paro lost his argument the moment that he said, I don't know who God is. I know that this may sound a little bit funny, but if he would have said, God, okay, he wants them to go now? Fine. I have no problem with that. Please go, because I've been working in the service of God till now. And then presumably the whole judgment that would have been upon him would have been very different. But again, I want you to pay attention to the words. God is saying is they will be enslaved, they will be abused, but v'gamata goya sher yavodu dan anochi. I am going to judge them. So why judge them? To judge them, to see exactly how they did this, and to see did they go further than they needed to do? Were they abusive over here? V'achreichein, and afterwards they're going to leave with a great deal of wealth. Now, all of these elements have to be fit into the narrative that's going to unfold now over this week and next week's Parsha. So I'm just pointing out, if you want to figure out what's taking place over here, it's the Dan Anochi. That's why Paro is part of the story. Paro still is going to need to receive the punishments that he has deserved or he's earned here along the way. And the other point we need to get to is that they're going to leave Berchush Gadol. I'll point out something which maybe needs to be pointed out. One of the things that troubles us sometimes is the perception that Paro's free will was suspended. I'm not at all convinced that when we read the verses that we can really justify that. But as I said, there's certainly a perception of that. The first thing that God says regarding the free will being suspended has nothing to do with Paro, but has to do actually with the people. And if you take a look at source number 5 now, Pasuk Kaf Aleph, which is toward the end, actually, let's start by Pasuk Yutet. V'ni yadati. And just to appreciate where this is, we're at the burning bush right now. And God has said to go, and Moshe said, I don't know, I don't think I'm the right one, and power's not going to listen, and so on. And God keeps on saying to Moshe to go, to go, to go, to go. And after finally, you know, I'm not going to say Moshe has acquiesced at that point. Look at Pasuk Yudchet. I'm sorry, I keep going backwards. Yudchet. V'shamu l'kolecha, uvata ata v'ziknei Yisrael o'melech Mitzrayim. Right? The elders are going to come with you. The elders don't come with him. The elders back away. Rashi says the elders disappear. Pasuk Yutet, v'niyadati, ki lo yitein etchem melech Mitzrayim loch, v'lo biyad chazaka. He's not going to let you go until he's forced to do it. Which means, Moshe says, you know, God, is power going to let us go? And, you know, he's not going to listen to us. And God says, yeah, you're right, he's not going to listen. I'm going to have to, v'shalachti yadi, v'keti Mitzrayim b'chol neflotai. I'm going to have to force his hand. You see, it's actually, it's the opposite of what you think. It's the plagues that impinge on the free will, and not the free will itself. Which means, what does Paro want in his heart of hearts? Never to let the Jews go. That's what he wants. As it says, he's not going to let them go. But when God starts giving him plague after plague after plague, the plague is the thing which takes him away. That's the thing that breaks his resolve. So God then hardens his heart to allow him to do what his free will really wants him to do. So I'm just saying, it's the opposite of what we think sometimes. But the next pasuk, V'natati chen ha'am hazeh be'enei Mitzrayim. So the first thing that should remind you of is if you ever say a Tefillat HaDerech. What's in the Tefillat HaDerech? Among other things, you should be safe. But what else in the Tefillat HaDerech? That the place that you go and the people that you meet, you should find favor in their eyes. I mean, people are suspicious of strangers. I don't know why. I guess there's some kind of a psychological wiring that maybe we perceive as being self-defense, but we have this fear of strangers. So what it's saying is that when you are a stranger and people meet you, they will see within you this chen that you have. They will see within you the sweetness that you have. They will like you. They will appreciate you. And that's what we say in the Tefillat HaDerech. But what's it saying here? That even though you're slaves, and even though generally slaves are looked upon as being subhuman, you will find favor in their eyes. And when you leave, you're not going to leave empty-handed. For shala isha mishchenta umigarat beta klei kesef klei zahav usmalot. You're going to ask them for gold and silver, and I will point out smalot are there as well. Clothing is also there, which may also be counterintuitive. I'll mention something about that. V'samto b'necha v'benotechem, and you're going to use the clothing, by the way. Unitzalt mitzrayim, and then you're going to leave. Which means the only thing that is spoke about over here that God impinges on the free will is that they will suddenly like you and give you their things. But that was part of the Brit Bein HaPtarim. That's what God had said. You're going to leave Berchush Gadol. You're going to leave with things. I know that there is this teaching that when the Jews left, they left because they didn't change their clothing, they didn't change their names, they didn't change, what else didn't they change? Their language. So clothing was not there in the original Midrash. Not only is clothing not there, it's actually contradicted by the verse itself, because you're going to take the clothing. You're going to take the clothing. And the clothing itself became very popular, I would say, in a Hasidic time. Moving onward from there, where Levush became something very, very important. But it's always interesting when you have something which is just so well known that is actually contradicted by the verse itself. So let's try again now. When I say the trajectory is jagged, which means it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. Let's go back to what we were up to towards the beginning once again. When Moshe finally comes in front of Paro, Paro says, I never heard of God. And then what happens? Paro says, you're really bothering these people. And he seems to be implying, you know what, they have too much time in their hands. And therefore my response to you is not just I'm not letting them go, I am taking away the raw materials. They're going to go collect the raw materials and go let them go and do all the work, keep up to the amount of work they needed to do, but now they have to go collect materials as well. And, of course, things got worse, and that's part of what I want to point out, that if I were to say that, you know, there's a phrase which is used sometimes today. The phrase is used, the hitchalta de geula, the beginning of the redemption. The phrase is used one time in the Talmud, And by the way, it's talking about war. It says sometimes to shake things up and move things drastically, a war can accomplish that. And it says war is also the beginning of the redemption. If the beginning of the redemption is when Moshe comes back, I don't know when the beginning is, by the way. Maybe we'll discuss that as we move on now. If the beginning of redemption is when Moshe comes back and tells the Jews, Pakot Pakadate, as we saw last week, and then they go to Paro, so now we've started. The process of redemption has begun. And what's the first thing that happens is that instead of moving towards redemption, we move the other way. And that's exactly what I want you to note, is that instead of going forward, we move backwards. And that's exactly what bothers Moshe as we get to the end of Parakeh, is then the leaders come and say, what in the world did you do? That's Pasuk Yutet. V'yirushal trei b'nei Yisrael, otam bara lemor, lo trigum levnechem dvar yom yomo, v'yifku al Moshe v'aron, nitzavim lo kratam b'tzeta meid paro. And they were waiting for Moshe and Aaron when they come out, v'yom aleichem, yirei Hashem aleichem v'yishpot, may God judge. Hivashtem et rechanu be'enei paro v'enei avodav l'teit cherev bi'adam l'argenu. You've made our lives that much more difficult. And then, as we get towards the end, vayashav Moshe el Hashem vayomar. Moshe goes back and says, Hashem, lama hareotem la'amazeh. Why have you made lives more difficult for the people? Lama zeh shelachtani. Why did you send me? Which means Moshe is saying, again, we're not getting better. Umiyaz bati el paro ledaber b'shemecha, heira la'am hazeh. And ever since you sent me to Paro, things have deteriorated. V'hatzel, you know, salvation, lo itzalta tamecha. You didn't save your people. And then we end. So it's interesting. This is now, you realize now why we think this is part of last week's parsha still. V'yomar shem el Moshe, atatir asher aseh leparo. Now you're going to see what I'm going to do to Paro. And again, I asked before, why is Paro part of the story? Because that already goes back to Brit Ben Abtarim, the Gamet Agoydan Anochi. And it could very well be, and again, I'm not going to speak about the ethics, the morals, you can all debate this for yourselves. Was it necessary for the Jews to see Egypt and Paro suffer? Apparently it is. Again, sometimes a person is victimized, and it's worthwhile psychologically for them to see this, but it's even stronger here, because Paro is perceived as a god, and part of leaving Egypt is this divinity, or this imagined divinity, needs to be brought down and to be showed how indeed human he is, and therefore Paro is part of the story, because it could be that they're not completely free until they're also free of all the mythology from Egypt. And as some of you know, we've spent a lot of time discussing how the various plagues do connect to the Egyptian mythology. Now, as we move forward, you know, in this week's parsha and the various plagues, this is constantly going to happen. There is going to be a moving forward and a moving backwards and a stagnation. And along the way, we're not getting where we think that we are supposed to be getting to. And I'll say it again. There was an option over here. The option is that God could have just taken them out magically, flown them out on if you want, wings of eagles or on an Ne'a Kavod and taken them straight, not even Har Sinai, straight to Eretz Yisrael, which seems to be the stated objective. So, having said all that, I want to now go back a little bit. I do want to get back to the burning bush, but before that, let's go to source number 3 and go to what I think maybe really is the beginning of the redemption, but it's a beginning of redemption that then gets stalled, and you don't have to read it the way I'm about to read it, but I do want to think a little bit. Before we read Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Bet, Moshe comes out, he looks both ways, what had happened, he comes looking for his brothers, and he finds an Egyptian beating his brother, and he gets involved. Let's pause there for a second. Who is Moshe? Or perhaps, who is Moshe at this point? And I'll ask it very simply in terms of identity, and most importantly in terms of self-identity. At this point, is Moshe a Mitzri, or is Moshe an Ivri? Is Moshe a Mitzri, or is Moshe an Ivri? What is his self-identity? And I don't... What is he, a Mitzri, or is he an Ivri? You know, you can go, when those of you going back to America can ask your kids, are you American Jews, are you Jewish Americans? What is your basic identity? Who are you for real when it really comes down to it? If indeed you say both, I don't like the answer. Because when push comes to shove, then who really are you? What is your identity? So now it could be that on face value, we would have a hard time imagining that Moshe actually could identify with himself as an Ivri, but I think that there's no question about it when you look in the verses. First of all, it says that he leaves the palace and he looks for his brothers. He seeks his brothers. He sees an Egyptian beating one of his brothers, and that's incredibly important because normatively, if you see a master beating a slave, especially if you're from the master class, and he's from the palace, the first thing that goes through your head is, what do the slaves do? I mean, there's no question the slave deserves it, because the slave is a slave. And that's simply the politics of this. And therefore, it's obvious the slave must have done something wrong, but that's not the way that Moshe processes this. Moshe's process is that I need to protect my brother. Now, let's go back a little bit, things that we should know. One, why is Moshe's named Moshe? Is this a Jewish name? Is this his Ivri name? Or is this his Mitzri name? It's his Mitzri name. Who names him this? Paro's daughter names him this. Why does Paro's daughter name him this? Because this seems actually a little strange. She says, his name is Moshe, because I took him out of the water. Now, all the Jewish kids were being thrown in the water. So if she says, I took him out of the water, she's essentially admitting that this is one of the Jewish kids, which is not the best way for Moshe to have a safe existence. However, this goes back to the issue of mythology. There's a pasuk in Yecheskel, which we'll read in the Haftarah, which it says that God says, I'm on to you, Paro Melech Mitzrayim, Hatanin Hagadol Horvet Mitoch Yarav, the big crocodile who slithers about his river, or alligator if you prefer, it's crocodile, who slithers about his river saying, Li Ori Vani Asitini, the river is mine and I created it. So the mythology in Egypt is such, at least according to Yecheskel, that Paro is the god of the Nile. What is his daughter's name? Bitya. Now, Bitya ends up leaving with the Jewish people when by the Geula. Is that a midrash or is that a pasuk that she leaves? Is that a midrash or is that a pasuk? On the spot. It's a pasuk. It's a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim. And Divrei Hayamim tells us that Bitya married so-and-so and she had her own kids and she left Egypt and she came with the Jews. Which really is impressive because it goes back to this point of, you know, who is Moshe at this point. But by naming him Moshe, and by let me pause one more time. Paro orders for the Jewish kids to be killed and they won't do it. So he says, okay, throw them in the water instead. If they're not willing to kill them, why would they throw them in the water? Because apparently they saw the water as being something which was alive. And they say the water is going to judge whether this kid will live or die. Let me start again. If Paro's daughter wants to protect Moshe, why doesn't she just say, well, this was a virgin birth and this is something miraculous? So the truth is she said something better than this. She said the Nile gave birth to this child, which means she established Moshe as a god in Egypt. Moshe is a god. He was born of the Nile. So just like Paro is the god of the Nile, he now in the palace is part of this Egyptian mythology. So for Moshe to walk out of the palace and identify with the Jews and as a Jew, this is probably the worst career move that anybody ever had in Tanakh. Why? Because he's about to sacrifice being a god to becoming just identified with the slaves. See, I know people love to use the phrase Mesiras Nefesh. This is Mesirat Nefesh. This is the type of Mesirat Nefesh that I think you really can't imagine. And I'm saying all of this to go back to Moshe's state of mind at the time. There's no question in my mind, at least, that Moshe's parents raised him to believe that he was a Jew. He's an Ivri. He is one of these. He's identified not with the ruling class, not with the divine class. He is identified with the slaves. And his actions illustrate this. I mean, it proves this. He understands he's one of them. And by doing what he did is he took his whole life and puts it in danger. And indeed it was. I mean, Paro finds out. Paro wants to kill him. And Moshe is a smart enough person to anticipate that that was at least a possibility that Paro will find out about this sooner rather than later. So what is Moshe thinking? So what I'm about to say is something which I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I'm going to completely accept it without any kind of critical analysis. When I say by that critical analysis is that you could argue, you can say, I don't see it, but I'm going to say what he said. He believes that Moshe thought of himself at that point as being the Redeemer. I know the reason that you're going to think, what are you talking about? Because even when God finally talks to him, he says, no, I'm me, and I can't be, and so on. But I want you to keep in mind about what we're about to see. Moshe looks both ways, right? And he kills Vayachet HaMitzri V'Tmeinu B'chol, and he buries him in the sand. I've mentioned once before this idea, which I think people know, but I'm not sure if they know exactly. And again, there could be other sources for this. But in source number 4, I have a book which is very rare. It's called Margoliot Shel Torah. It's written by a rabbi named Rabbi Meir Goldberg, who the odds are extremely strong you'd never heard of. But I'll tell you who Rabbi Meir Goldberg was. First of all, we have letters written from Rav Kook to Rabbi Meir Goldberg. The reason why we have these letters is because Rav Meir Goldberg, born in Europe, came to Eretz Yisrael, learnt in Rav Kook's yeshiva in Yafo. He was one of Rav Kook's talmidim, in Yafa. Rav Kook then went during, he went to Europe for a short amount of time, which ended up to be for 3 years because World War I broke out and he got stuck first in Switzerland, and then he went to England for 2 years. He was a rabbi there. And while Rav Kook was away, first of all, many of the people that were in Yafo got sent to Egypt because of the politics involved in World War I, and Meir Goldberg ended up coming to America, and then he ended up going to the Bay Area, and he lived the rest of his life in the Bay Area, and he would tell people, I have smicha from Rav Kook. And he ended up writing a book, and he was an Orthodox fellow. He ended up making a lot of money in real estate. Listen to what he says. And there is some of Rav Kook in this. That's what's interesting. By the way, the two Rebbeim in Rav Kook's yeshiva in Yafo, which, as I said, fell apart. One was a man named Rav Shach, who was not related to Rav Shach, and he was killed in 1929 during the riots. And the other one was a man by the name of Rabbi Yom Tov Geffen, who is a great-great-grandfather of an Israeli musician whose name is Aviv Geffen. So that's, anybody who's ever heard of Aviv Geffen, if you ever meet Aviv Geffen, say, I don't know if you've ever learned your great-grandfather's sefer, but Rav Kook held him in the highest esteem. Going back to his student, Rav Meir Goldberg, Vayach, Moshe hits the Mitzri, is 36. Vayach is 36. Like Kiminyan, Lamedved Kritot. Moshe karate the Mitzri. Karate the chitzonim. Vayitmein bechulin. It says he put him in chol. Chol is chulin. Chol is the opposite of holiness. Hamitzri sharag Moshe, this Egyptian that Moshe killed, hadeyot shamitzrayim shemoshe lamad. Moshe killed the Egyptian ideas that he had learned while in the palace. Chitzoniyut b'li elohut. He got rid of all of these external things that had no divinity in them. Harag v'taman b'chulin. He went and he buried them in things which were completely unholy. Kimosha b'gematria hamitzri. Because Moshe in gematria is equal to hamitzri. So what he's saying is that aside from the Egyptian that Moshe killed, which he's not addressing at all, there was another Egyptian that Moshe killed when he killed the other Egyptian, and that was himself. Moshe killed the Egyptian in himself when he goes out. So when I ask the question is, who's Moshe? Is he a Mitzri or is he a Yivri? So you can claim both prior to killing the Egyptian, but the moment he kills the Egyptian, he also kills the Egyptian of himself. Again, not just that Paro is going to want to chase him down, or not just that he runs away and he's no longer in Egypt. It's that at that point, this whole identity, this whole other identity that was created for him, becomes completely exploded, not just in how people will perceive him, but Moshe's own perception. I am not a... It's like he rips off the clothing, if you want to say, and then he takes out the cape and he becomes Superman, but that's actually a part of it. The next day, when Moshe comes out... I'm going to have to separate you two. The next day when Moshe comes out and he sees two Jews fighting... I have to stop there for a second. Moshe's not raised with the Jewish community. So I think that there are various people who are not raised in the Jewish community have certain imaginations about how wonderful we all must be. And just to see a Jew hitting another Jew, that Egyptians act that way, that Egyptians beat Jews, that he's seen. But to see that a Jew's beating another Jew in his mind is just so horrific. And by the way, it most likely breaks his heart to see that there, it's possible even for a Jew to be beating another Jew. This can't really possibly be. And he says, you know, you wicked person, how can you do this? And they turn around and they say, what, you're going to kill us the same way that you killed the Egyptian? So I want you to understand something about this. Moshe at that moment sacrificed everything in order to be with the Jews, in order to lead them. Again, this is a young Moshe, you know, when he's still idealistic. Remember when we all were idealistic? You don't even remember anymore. When we were all idealistic, but then at some point the idealism gets traded for pragmatism, and that's part of the tragedy of all of our lives. Moshe at that moment is, he's ready to lead. But what's the problem? He comes to this total realization that they're not ready to follow. They're not ready to be redeemed. They're not ready to leave. They still, if you want to call it a slave mentality, how could two Jews be beating one another? This is impossible. But not only that, what do they say to him? Who put you in charge? Let's read the pasuk. Sorry, back in source number 3. Vayomer, mi samcha leish sar v'shofet aleinu. Who put you in charge of us? Well, what Moshe was anticipating is, hold it, let's stop a second. Moshe is born, and Rashi tells us, the house fills up with light. Why? Because Moshe's the chosen one. By the way, what I want you to note now is the up and down in Moshe's life. He's the chosen one. Light fill, but then they have to put him in the water. So then we deflated. But then Paro's daughter saves him. So then, okay, then he goes back to his mother, then goes to the palace, then he walks out of the palace. And now he's ready to live the life that most likely he has been told from the earliest days that you are special, you are going to be raised in the palace, you will have opportunity and means that nobody else will have, you are going to be raised for leadership. Just think about that for a second. Think about what God just now did. I need to make sure that Moshe is going to have leadership qualities, so let me send him to leadership finishing school in the palace itself in order for him to understand now what exactly a leader needs to do. He's raised this way. But he's also raised another way, and that's the other way that he's raised, that he's a Jew. So now he's going to walk out of the palace. He's going to see the Jews. He says, I'm here. Okay, let's go. It's time to go. And what do they say? Now notice the words they say to him. Mi samcha le'ish sar v'shofet aleinu? Who put you in charge? See, Chazal tell us that this is Datan Avir, and later on in Parshat Korach, they're going to say the exact same thing to him. Who put you in charge? Right? It's the rebellion against Moshe's leadership. That's why they say it's the same two characters, because what do you mean who put him in charge? Well, God is the one who created this and put him in charge. But Moshe now realizes the Jews are not ready to leave, and I don't know how to go further with this. And that's what we're going to have to read and learn a little bit more now. Maybe at this point Moshe says, okay, it's not going to happen. Let's continue. Pasuk Tedvav, Yishma Paro Tedvar Zev, Yivakesh Larogat Moshe. Okay, that's it. This is not an unanticipated event. This is absolutely anticipated, that Paro is going to hear about this and want to kill him. V'yivrech Moshe mipnei Paro, he runs away. V'yeshev be'eretz Midyan, he settles in the land of Midyan. And the word settles over here is interesting. Remember Parsha Vayeshev, it says, Yaakov Bikesh, Leshevet Bishalva, that Vayeshev indicates a settling, getting used to it. Vayeshev al Habe'er. Ulukohen Midyan Sheva Banot, we know the story, but he's a Kohen Midyan, and we have to pay attention to that. And he goes and he chases away the other people, and he gives them, and right, Vayigar Shum, he chases them away, and he gives them food. And Pasuk Yudchet, Vatavone El Ruel Avim, they come back to their father. Vayomim Adu Mehartim Bo Hayom, and he says to them, you know, why did you come back so quickly today? Vatomarna Ish Mitzri Tzilanu Miyad Orim, an Egyptian man saved us. Gam Dalo Delalanu, right, he poured the water, Vayash Etzon, and he gave water to the flock. Now only a father who's got seven unmarried daughters can respond this way. Where is he? Why did you let him out of your kirhenelah? Bring him home. Like, what's the matter with you people? Not only is he a man, I mean, that's enough, but he seems to be a good man. He seems to be a decent man. He seems to be a moral man. Bring this man home. The problem is going to be the next two words. Vayoel Moshe. Okay, we'll read it in context. Vayoel Moshe l'shevet ta'ish. So I don't know how you would translate that. But it sounds that Moshe became accustomed, Moshe accepted to say, but it's again Leshevet. So it's not that not just that he goes Vayeshev Be'eretz Midyan, Moshe becomes settled with this man, Vayiten et Tzipora Bito LeMoshe. And he now marries Tzipora. Now I want to read two midrashim about this. One is bad and the other is worse. So we'll start with bad and then we'll move to worse. Bad is in source 18. Vayo Moshe. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Shenishbalo, Ve'en Vayoel El Loshon Shvua, Shenemar, Vayoel Sha'ol Ta'am, V'lama Hishbiu, why did he make him swear? Omar Lo, Yitro says to him, by the way, let's stop for a second. Who is Yitro? Yitro is from Midian. Who is Midian? Who's Midian's father? A man by the name of Avraham Avinu. This is one of the B'nai Keturah. Which means that Moshe leaves Paro, who's from the family of Cham, and he goes over to Midian, who's from Shem. Knowing the distinction between the Shem family and the Cham family will allow you to understand the second half of Sefer Bamidbar, where all the people from Cham are to be chased away and to be conquered, and all the people from Shem are able to stay in the place that they are. Which means Moshe goes and finds somebody who's actually a distant relative, and somebody who should at least get some of what or who Moshe is. But listen to the way that Yitro exploits his knowledge according to the Midrash. Amulo, yodei ani sheYaakov avichem shenatan lo Lavan benotav, natnan valach lo chutz midato. I know what happened in the family. I know that when Yaakov went to work for his father-in-law, what did Yaakov already do in the middle? He just took the kids and took the family and he ran away and he left. Shema imetein lecha et biti ata oseh likach. Because maybe you're going to do the same thing to me. Miyad nishbalo, Moshe swore that he would never leave. V'natan lo tzipora. So that's a little frightening, which means if I'm correct in saying that Moshe was born to lead, and Moshe knows he's supposed to lead, and Moshe leaves the palace to lead them, and they say, who are you? And Moshe walks away. This would indicate that Moshe at this point has given up in terms of his role, been there, done that, tried, failed. Now I'm going to move on, take a job, work for my father-in-law, and that's it. So that's bad. You want to see worse now? Worse is in the Mechilta. And now before I read the Mechilta, I want to remind you about what the Mechilta is. The Mechilta is incredibly authoritative. The Mechilta has the same stature as a Mishnah. Maybe slightly less because that's a Mishnah. This is not the Mishnah. The Mechilta is the halacha connected to Psukim as opposed to be put topically. But as I said, quite old, quite authoritative, and in this instance, quite disturbing. Bishasha Moshe Liyitro, Tain li tzipora bitcha li'isha, amar lo Yitro, kabel alecha devar zeh sha'omer lecha, v'ani notna lecha li'isha, accept the deal I'm going to put forth, and then we can proceed. Amar lo mahu, what's the deal? Amar lo ben she'elecha tchila, your firstborn son, ye'elevo dezara. He's mine, and he will be raised for a life of idolatry. Yitro is saying, listen, I got no sons. I need someone to take over the family business. I need somebody to become the new Kohen Midyon. I need somebody who's going to be a priest for idolatry. And he says, first son is mine. Mikan ve'elach l'shem shemayim. From here forward, you can go and follow the God of Abraham, anything that you want. V'kibila love. And Moshe accepted this. Omer lo hishvali. He says, swear to me. V'yishvalo. And he swore to them. Shenemar v'yo Moshe. That Moshe swore. Moshe swore and he made this deal. Which means when I say that Moshe turns from this idealistic individual to becoming this person who now settles with his father-in-law, it was bad enough according to Shmot Rab, yeah, I'm staying. I'm not going anyplace. This is you're my people now. So when I asked before, is Moshe an Ivri, is Moshe a Mitzri? So apparently now he's a Midyani. He's willing to settle and to live there. But if I look in the Mechilta, it's even worse. Although there's one aspect of it maybe is better because he acknowledges that there is this thing called monotheism. He acknowledges that Moshe may be something else, but nonetheless that Moshe could have agreed to this. Incidentally, this is not a college education. Incidentally, if you look in Shoftim, source, one second, I don't have to, I have to look at Shoftim. If you look, one second. Continue the Mechilta, because we're going to have to come back to this. Lefichach, therefore, hikdima malach la rogit Moshe. One of the things that we never understood when we read the narrative, especially last week, when Moshe finally heads towards Egypt, God sends a malach to kill him. What did Moshe do wrong? So listen, that's what the Mechilta, that's actually the motivation of the Mechilta. It says, Lefichach hikdim malach lahoreget Moshe, miyad v'dikach tzpor tzorvet echratet orla binah. And then that stopped it. Which means if we now reconstruct what this Mechilta is telling us, is why did Tzipora does a Brit Milah for one of her kids. Which one? There's two possibilities, the older one or the younger one. The younger one is actually a little easier for us to understand, because then we can imagine he was just born, Moshe has to go, and Moshe leaves right away. It's dangerous to do Brit Milah right now or to travel Brit Milah, so let's wait, and God doesn't like that. Well, why doesn't God like that? We're not exactly 100% sure. The way the Mechilta is reading the story, it's completely different. It's saying, is which kid doesn't have a Brit Milah? The older one doesn't have a Brit Milah. Why? Because he was already traded. He was traded away. He was already given away to his grandfather, and he is going to become an idolater. Now, you want to see how seriously Rashi takes this point. If you look in Source 21, it's a Pasuk in Shoftim, V'yikim olhem b'nei Dan et ha-paso. V'yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe, hu v'nav yu ha-konim l'shevet ha-dani ad yom gelot ha-aretz. This was the family of those who served idolatry in Sefer Shoftim. But it says, Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. Rashi writes, ben Menashe, b'nei kvodo shamosha katuv nun l'shanot et ha-shem. V'nichtav tluya lomar shelo haya Menashe ela Moshe. That Moshe ends up having descendants who are idolaters because he was willing to make this deal. As I said, Rashi says that pshat in Shoftim, that who is this Gershom ben Menashe? It's not Gershom ben Menashe. It's Gershom ben Moshe, that Moshe ends up having a descendant who is involved in idolatry. So that is something which I hope is as disturbing to you as it is to me. Now, when we get... See, part of what I hope we gained now is when we go to the burning bush in source number 5. This is a Moshe who, on the one hand, was willing to sacrifice everything to lead the people and now has settled in Midian. That's where he is, and that's who he is. But nonetheless, there's some things we need to pay attention to. One, he's become a shepherd. Becoming a shepherd is not a simple choice, because as we know from the end of Bereishit, that's the most detestable thing for the Egyptians, but that's who he is right now. And it is what the Jews have always done, which means, in a certain sense, Moshe now really is going back to his true identity. That's point number one. Point number two is it says, "Vayinhag et hatzon achar hamidbar, vayavo har elokim chareva." So it's as if a magnet is bringing him to a place which is called Har Elokim, and brings him to a place that will one day become Chorev, one place will become Har Sinai. And Moshe heads, I also want you to pay attention to the geography. Midian is higher up, Sinai is lower down, and Egypt is even further lower down. So Moshe is over here, and God starts to speak to him. And God says, you know, you're so much as, who am I? So the who am I by itself, who am I to take the Jews out? Well, actually, he's internalized what they have said to him. Who are you to lead us? So now Moshe repeats that. Who am I? They're not going to listen to me. He's not saying this because he's guessing this. He's saying this because he experienced this. And that just makes it completely different. But God nonetheless says, no, don't worry. I got your back. I'm going to be with you. But again, there is this, I want to go back to the trajectory. Nonetheless, God says, but Pharaoh's not going to listen to you. So Moshe's, like the whole thing becomes completely confusing because we're going back, we're going forth, we're going back. And now let's then continue when Moshe finally seems to agree. And I want to go to source number 9. Vayelech Moshe vayashav el yeter chotno. He goes back to his father-in-law. Vayomer lo, and now listen to the way that he phrases it. El chana vashuva el achai. I want to go back and I want to see my brothers. By the way, he doesn't say what God told him to do. He doesn't say, I'm going to Paro Melech Mitzrayim and say, let my people go. He says, I want to go with my brothers, Asher b'Mitzrayim, v'reh odam chayim. I want to see, visit my family, see if they're still around. V'yumet v'lo Moshe, lech l'shalom, go ahead. Now, at this point, what did God say? What does Moshe say? He says nothing about his wife. He says nothing about his children. He says, I'm going to go. And then suddenly, God comes and speaks to him. V'yom Hashem Moshe b'Midyan. Lech Shev Mitzrayim, go back, go. Now notice what he did. Instead of getting the message and going directly to Egypt, so I understand there may be some practical points here. He has all the flock with him, he has to return the flock. But nonetheless, instead of going south, he goes north. And now the other question that you don't want to ask yourselves is, and how much time has gone by? Did a day go by, a week go by, a month go by? How long has Moshe been ruminating about what God has told him to do? And has he really accepted it? Now, the thing which is somewhat damning, and again, maybe you can explain this differently, and the commentaries have a very hard time on this point. Go. So now, how does he say it? Does God say it very sweetly? You know, okay. Or go, you know, like, what are you waiting for? Go. And I'll say it again. I don't know the answer to this. Did a month go by? Did a year go by? Did 5 years go by? And we don't have any way of evaluating this. What I will say, and again, I told you we're going to keep on jumping back and forth. What I will say is that when I get to go back to source number 3, after Moshe has already settled and so on with Yitro, married Tzipporah, Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Vayhi B'Yamim Ahem, we're told that the Melech Mitzrayim has died, Vayizaku, and the Vayenchu B'nei Yisrael Min Avodah Vayizaku, they scream out. Vatal shavatam elokim minavodah, and God has heard their cries. Vayishma elokim minakotam, vayiskor elokim brito et Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov, vayar elokim b'nei Yisrael, vayeda elokim. Now all of that is beautiful. The only problem that I have is that all of that is repeated in the beginning of this week's parsha. All the same words were used in this week's parsha. right? God says, I've heard their cry. And God says, I've seen their suffering. And so all the same words are used over here. And now, again, I get to this point. So now how much time has been going on over here from the very beginning until we get to this point where God says to Moshe, go. So we're back in source number 9. God says to him, go already. And he adds, Moshe said, I want to see if my brothers are still alive. And God says, Ki metu kol anashim avakshim et nafshecha. Because all the people want to see you dead or no longer alive. Vikach Moshe tishto vet banav. So this is different from what he had said to Yitro. Now Moshe takes his wife and takes his children. And now he takes the staff. And now we finally get the sense that Moshe is ready to go. Which I believe is the first time that God says this. Which again, Moshe is finally ready to go. And what does God say? Oh yeah, by the way, it's not going to work. Now, if you're Moshe at this point, God just, you're finally going, and God says, yeah, but by the way, it's not going to work. But he adds the following. Israel is my firstborn. See, that's really interesting. Because Paro, we're told, was the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn, which means the visual of Egypt is a pyramid, which Paro is sitting on the top of the pyramid. Say that bini b'chor Yisrael, va'omar elecha shalachet bini v'yavdeni, v'tama'in l'shalcho, if he refuses, hinei enochi hareket bincha b'chorecha. I'm going to kill your firstborn, which is actually the man who will one day be king. Because Paro is the firstborn of the firstborn of the firstborn. His firstborn is the crown prince. He's the one who will take over. And God is saying, okay, you go tell him that my firstborn is Israel. And if you don't let my firstborn go, I'm going to kill your firstborn. What's interesting about this is the first plague that Moshe is told about is actually the final plague that takes place. We can't help but suspect, and the Midrash does this and says that this is also connected to killing the kids. Which means you've killed Jewish kids along the way. Your children are going to die as well. Which means this is part of the Brit Bein Abtarim, V'gamat Agoy Dan Anochi. This is part of the judgment that will take place. But what's interesting then is the next pasuk, because we're talking about the firstborn. That Israel's my firstborn. I'm going to kill your firstborn, and then we get to that mysterious stop. V'yehi b'derech mavlon v'yevakshehu Hashem v'yevakai shamito. God wanted to kill him. And that's what does God want to kill him? But which means I imagine this as not just a Brit Milah. This is also a conversion taking place. It's a conversion of Gershom, which is also an interesting name of being a stranger, of being somebody else, maybe even a stranger to Moshe, maybe even a stranger to us. And it's his mother who, by the way, converts at this moment as well. Her performance of the Brit Milah also clearly identifies who she is. She is part of the Jews. He is part of the Jews. Which means, in a sense, once we're talking about the firstborn, you can't ignore, you know, what we would sometimes call the elephant in the room, that Moshe has been willing to trade away his firstborn. Because by doing that, he is now not worthy to be leader. If we're already going to talk about firstborns, that becomes this uncomfortable, you know, family secret. Why, you traded off your firstborn to become somebody involved in idolatry? I mean, there are those who explain that Moshe wants Gershon to go through the same experience that he did. I was raised in a foreign house, and I walked out of the house, and therefore I became who I am. But you know what? We don't necessarily want to put our children to all the difficult things that we put in. As I said, there are those who explain it that way. And maybe when you're stuck, you need a good explanation. I gave a very bad explanation, which means it's very bad because the implications are very disturbing, that Moshe may have given up at that point, and Moshe may have stopped and said, you know, I'm just not the one, and this is not going to happen, and they don't want me. And Moshe says, I'm not going back. I'm just going to be staying over here. And that's what the Mechilta seems to be trying to say. As I said, both of these sources seem to be identifying this idea of Moshe leaving. Is he going to leave or not? Vayo Moshe, he's comfortable over here. He is part of Midian. He is part of Yitro's family. But nonetheless, he has this epiphany and God convinces him that he does have to go. Again, what I want you to see in Moshe's life is that it completely parallels the Exodus itself. The exit itself, as I said, it's a jagged trajectory. Go further, we go backwards, further backwards, further backwards. And now you realize that's exactly what took place in Moshe's life. Moshe, therefore, becomes actually the perfect person to lead the Geula, because he's experienced the same kind of anticipation, and then you know, like a dose of reality. This is going to happen. Okay, it's not going to happen. It's going to happen. It's not going to happen. And Moshe, experiencing all this, has actually gone through what Am Yisrael is going to go through before, which means the microcosm of Moshe's life actually is going to be expressed in the macrocosm of how the Geula takes place. I just want to pause here for a second and just say something as we move towards the conclusion. As I said in the very beginning, the actual redemption takes place suddenly. It takes place so quickly that the bread doesn't have time to rise. Part of what's important about everything that we learned today is that there is an absolute possibility that this is also the prototype for what is being experienced, starting, if you will. I don't know what date you want to start. You want to start the date when the first one of the Vilna Gaon students arrived in 1812 or so? And they began what we would know as the Old Yishuv, and the Jews came from the Sephardic lands, and the Hasidic students came, actually slightly before the Vilna Gaon students came, and people began to build up this place. And again, the early Yishuv was one which was very small. And finally, in 1948, we had 600,000 people here. That was the entire population. And we had 600,000 people who couldn't, and a small army who couldn't actually, they didn't have arms, they didn't have munitions really, they didn't have enough things, and they couldn't even communicate. You had Holocaust survivors who literally came out of camps, who were then next to somebody, and the only language they really spoke was Yiddish, and then next to somebody who did, and neither of them spoke Hebrew. And they're in one army. And I don't know if you know this, but you know, we have Yom HaZikaron the day before Yom HaTzmaut. And the reason for this is because Gush Etzion was massacred on the day before of the independence, which means on Hei Iyar, on that year, we declared independence. The day before, Yitzhak Rabin, who was somebody with a very strong military background, was standing by Har Radar, and he was getting information coming in over the walkie-talkie, or whatever it was that they had, the Kesha, whatever they had in those days, and he was told about the massacre in Gush Etzion, and the Egyptian army had come, and the Jordan army had come, and the Gush had fallen. And he had said that that's it. This is the end of the Yishuv. This experiment that we were going to try, it's already going to be over before it started. That's it. There's no way that we can possibly succeed. And then what ends up happening, again, there are ups and there are downs. And you know, every time that something bad happens, Andy, I know nothing about investing. I don't know anything about investing. But I'll say one thing, and you'll correct me later if you want to, but after I finish. I think people who react very quickly to markets end up doing very, very poorly. Rather, people should invest in things that they have very good reason to believe will long-term do well, and people are able to stay with the long-term strategies are the ones who are going to be successful, and the people who are constantly responding probably are going to be constantly losing money along the way because things went down. Okay, that's it. And what Jewish history has been a history where we're able to invest long-term, incredibly long-term. Asa for somebody who wanted immediate gratification. I'll trade my future, I'll trade everything for right now for a bowl of chillant. It must have been really good chillin. That's all that I'll say. But he was willing to trade everything right then. And again, if you go through from 1948 moving forward, and by the way, even before then, if you go through even what the old yeshuv went through, 80% of the students of the Gur died before they ever made it to Jerusalem when they were living up north. The amount of violence that they experienced, I think, is beyond our imagination. But nonetheless, there were downs, but there were these ups, and when these ups would take place, it gave us focus again. We're moving forward, which means what we're experiencing, and indeed we believe that we're in a time which is the Tchalt of the Geula, the beginning of the redemption, and I don't even know how much of the beginning we are right now. And yes, there are ups and downs. Every time there's something, God forbid, a terrorist attack or something, people pause and how can we deal with this and look at this terrible thing? But then we move further. We get to 1967, and we go to 1973, and onward and onward. And the process of redemption never was something which a trajectory which was absolute in one direction and never had ever and didn't have within it these pauses where things go down. That's what it was. I just want to end with a story that I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik, which he had as a tradition going back to his great-great-grandfather, Reb Chaim Volozhin. Reb Chaim Volozhin said to his students one day, I'll tell you how Mashiach is going to come. This is what's going to happen. Here's the scenario of the coming of Mashiach. He goes, one morning I'm going to wake up, I'm going to go to shul, I'm going to come home, I'm going to want to sit and learn a little bit, prepare my shiur. While I'm preparing my shiur, my wife is going to put something on the stove and start cooking, and she's going to say to me, Chaim, I know that when you learn, you don't pay attention to anything else around you, but please put the food off so it doesn't burn. She's then going to go to the store and buy some things that she needs. Anyway, I'm sitting and learning, and I look out the window, and I hear the sound, which just seems incredibly sweet. The birds are singing a happier tune than I've ever noticed, and the sun is shining in a brighter way than I've ever seen. And I stick my head out the window, and I look, and I said, is something going on? And the Gabbai says, Reb Chaim, you didn't hear? Mashiach came. And I say, oh my God, Mashiach came? What do I do now? Because on Shabbos afternoon, a button fell off of my jacket, of my Shabbos jacket, but my everyday jacket has all the buttons. So what should I wear to greet Mashiach? Should I wear my Shabbos jacket without a button or my weekday jacket with a button? And right then my wife walks in and she says, Chaim, the food is burning on the stove. What are you doing? And he says, that's how Mashiach is going to come. We're going to be preoccupied with everything else going on in life. And then suddenly, we're going to look out the window and see that Mashiach indeed has come.